Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com. On behalf of everybody at HeritageRadioNetwork.com, we'd like to send a special thank you to the Hearst Ranch, our biggest supporter and longest-running sponsor since we first started in 2009. Hearst Ranch is the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and grass-finished beef. Since 1865, the Hearst family has raised cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of the Central California coast. The result is beef with extraordinary flavor that's as memorable and natural as the surrounding landscape. For more information, visit www.hearstranch.com.
Well, here we are on Sunday, and I could not be more excited. This main course show is transformed through a series of meetings with me and Jack, and I couldn't be more excited about the future of the main course.
Yeah.
And Jack, yes.
Is it weird having a co-host that you can't see?
No, I like that better, actually. That's all what radio is about. So we're sponsored by Hearst Ranch. It's Sunday. We are broadcasting from Roberta's at 261 Moore Street. And we're about to start a new feature called the Week in Review. And that's really what I'm so excited about, because it's going to be this show's job to summarize a little bit what has happened in the past week on Heritage Radio Network. And I was always looking for good content. And of course, the content comes from our amazing hosts. And we have 27 great shows. And you know, it's this show's job now to kind of summarize the amazing people that have come through the studio. But before we start the week in review, I want to do a little obituary to Norman Corwin, who is 101 years old when he died. And this is an obituary written by William Grimes, who I believe was the food writer for the New York Times for a number of years. And I'll just quote from him. Pretty powerful guy, Norman Corwin, when it comes to radio. Norman Corwin, one of the last living links to radio's golden age, was a producer and a dramatist whose innovative use of sound effects and unusual narrative devices attracted new audience to serious programming. He died on Tuesday at his home in Los Angeles. Life magazine called him radio's top dramatic genius. In 1944, the New York Post wrote, "He has earned the daring reputation of being the first to credit radio audiences with intelligence." I love this quote from one of Norman's radio broadcasts. On VE Day, May 8th, 1945, Mr. Corwin presented what may have been his most famous broadcast. It was called On a Note of Triumph, a celebration of the Allied struggle for victory, with the score by Bernard Herrmann. This is from his radio show that was narrated by Martin Gabel. So they've given up. They've finally done in, and the rat is dead in an alley back on the Wilhelmstrasse. Take a bow, G.I., take a bow, little guy. The Superman of tomorrow lies at the feet of the common men of this afternoon. This is it, kid. This is the day. Here's a little quote from Norman himself. "I'm governed by the potentialities of radio," he told the New York Post in 1944. "Even in the best shows, they're only dimly realized. Radio has given us, for the first time, a selective ear, just as the movie gave us a selective eye." So thank you, Norman Corwin. Rest in peace. And now we'll get to the week in review.
Yes.
Jack.
So I guess the most significant thing is now we are saying, as a whole, the station fully endorses Occupy Wall Street.
Oh my God, that was so. And we've gotten some serious reaction on the emails. I mean, one guy was pissed.
Yeah, well,
he was very angry with us.
We've actually been covering it longer than most people. It was September 23rd, I believe, that Joanne first started talking about the occupation on her show, Flash Talks Cash.
She was the first, huh, who kind of broke Wall Street for us?
Yeah, you know, as soon as it started happening, she started talking about it, and now she is the official accountant for the entire movement. So she's taking all those donations that are coming in, and she's doing the accounting for free for the protesters. So
she is amazing. Well, I'm, Jack, like you, a big believer in separation of corporation and state. And we've had a very interesting bunch of shows because Nicole Taylor covered it, right?
Right, and she was also one of the first. She had some people at the occupation calling into the show and telling us how they're feeding the protesters. A lot of chefs are donating their equipment to the protesters. So yeah, we've been on this for a while.
And now we're going to get into this great Mother Jones article that you CC'd everybody on yes. your biweekly email. But let's just to get into the lens of, because basically Michael Pollan called for all foodies to get to Occupy Wall Street, to make this a big food issue as well. And Erica Wides on her show, Chef Smarty Pants, actually had a little thing about the kind of BS that goes on by these big corporations talking about cage-free eggs,
yes,
right?
Yes, that's right.
Do you have a clip of that, Jack?
Yes, let me
pull that up. Listen to that.
Well, cage-free egg operations are, you know, it's better, but it's not all that different. Cage-free means that instead of the hens living in little cages, they're now crammed into these gigantic buildings. So I kind of hate to break it to you here, but all those free-range and cage-free eggs, it's not for the chickens, it's for you. It's to make you feel better and to make you spend more because you think you're buying a better product.
Yeah.
Ooh, that's from your Daily Bite. I love that. Yes. I feel like I'm at an airport whenever I hear that. But, you know, and you gave this great, Mother Jones is a great magazine. And, you know, just some of the quotes that I thought were, you know, interesting is, you know, the way power is concentrated in all aspects of the economy, you know, and how much money is poured towards lobbying. Which seems weird to me that senators and House of Representatives are allowed to accept that money. I mean, they are the moment of the hourglass where that sand comes through.
Absolutely.
By accepting the money, that's where all the problem is. I mean, of course, people can offer it. But this was a great article written by Tom Philpott. And, you know, three companies now process more than 70% of all beef in the United States. He writes that, and he also writes in antitrust theory, when four players control more than 40% of the market, they're said to wield market power, which is to say that they can manipulate the prices they charge consumers and the terms on which they deal with their suppliers. So rather than raise prices, the food industry has slashed costs at the expense of workers, farmers, and the environment. He talks about, you know, animal factories wielding crazy amounts of ammonia into local communities.
Wow.
And yeah, they also talk about driving up prices that literally directly starve people in places like Africa. And, you know, when I heard that Goldman Sachs was doing that, I kind of just wondered, if you work for Goldman Sachs in a, you know, managerial or, you know, any type of legitimate job, not, you know, cleaning the floors. I mean, some people have to work to survive. But if you've chosen to work there, are you by definition a scumbag?
An interesting question.
I don't know. I know that sounds a little harsh, but I think that was the whole problem with like Nazi Germany, is that there were all these Germans that quietly let stuff happen and accepted, you know, a living and just went on doing their thing, when in reality, horrible things were happening. And I wonder if you are in fact complicit in these types of decisions and futures trading and all that. But maybe I'm getting too negative. But, you know, it does, when I hear that people starve in Africa because of decisions made on Wall Street at Goldman Sachs, I mean, I find that really troubling. And I think people have to start calling that out. And HRN is a huge supporter of a populist movement that demands justice. So anyway, back in more pleasant news.
More pleasant news.
More
yes.
news. We also had some amazing people come in. So who came in to talk about Nordic cuisine, Jack?
Well, we were damn close to getting Renee Redzepi from NOMA.
That would have been gold.
The flight schedule did not work out. But we had Adam Amann on, who he is a chef partner of Amann's Copenhagen. And yeah, you know, Mitchell Davis, the vice president of the James Beard Foundation, spoke
great show
to him. Just about the rise of Nordic cuisine and kind of how it's the exact opposite of the modernist movement. Whereas, you know, in Nordic cuisine, they're just presenting things very simply prepared, garnished even with rocks or dirt.
Hmm.
And it's all about just the freshest ingredients of the earth, of the area, you know, the local area.
So what is it? I mean, is there... I mean, one thing I always found interesting about Nordic cuisine is that they have no growing season to speak of, which is part of the reason why the Vikings had to go and conquer all these people and pillage and plunder, is because they literally couldn't raise enough food for themselves. So I'm interested, what is this food about? Like, what is the foundation of it?
Yeah, just that, just the earth, the land, and using what you have, and, you know, not putting things in cryovacs or sous vide-ing thing. It's just very simple.
It's so funny because, I always imagine the... it's a kind of liberating to not have much of a culinary tradition, because then you're free to develop one. Whereas like the Italians, I mean, they're always going to be entrenched in what they do. But that's very interesting. And you can just do a search for Taste Matters or Nordic Cuisine.
Nordic Cuisine. We'll pull it up. Yeah.
And then
interesting interview.
We also had, I'm very honored to have written a quote for the back of Bayreuth Market's Eat Good Food book, and he was on Let's Eat In, right?
Yes, Kathy Arway's show.
And I love it, because she had had someone who had written a book. She had had two people in a row who had written books on her show, and the one before Sam was someone who wrote a book, Cooking with Grace and Economy. And I thought, isn't the very definition of grace that you wouldn't say that you have grace? But anyway, this is a very good book that she interviewed today. Sam, I really like him. And this was my quote. If every American heeded the words in this book, we would live in the healthiest, cleanest, and most delicious country in the world. A little bit much, but anyway, I really admire Sam. And plus, he's a Palestinian guy. And I've never really known any Palestinians to be leading the sustainable food movement in San Francisco. I thought that was really cool that he has all these Palestinian dishes there. And his street is essentially like Sesame Street. He has an ice cream shop. He has a big market. He has this thing called 18 Reasons. Thank you, Kathy Irway, for inviting him. And I got to just ask this. We have a couple more minutes, Jack.
Yeah, sure.
What's this history of American wine in weird places like Virginia, North Dakota?
Yeah, that was really interesting. The couple who wrote the book, What to Eat with What to Drink, and a few other books, I believe, they were just kind of speaking to the history of American wine, which I did not realize. We used to make award-winning wines in Virginia, North Dakota, all these other places that are just not known for wine.
Very, very strange. And that was on Taste of the Past with Linda Palacio.
Right, exactly, yeah.
And on the drink theme, our final topic for this first ever Week in Review. These Week in Reviews will get better, but I love it. These shows are so interesting on this network. Bread-infused cocktails, the bagel cocktail. Is this true?
It is. Dave Arnold talked about how you could soak, say, vodka with an everything bagel, and your cocktail could taste like a bagel. Which I'm not sure if that's good or not. I mean, I don't know. What do you think? Would you want a cocktail that tasted like a bagel?
Well, I hear... I mean, what is the view of vodka in general? I mean, we have Damon Bolte's Speakeasy.
Well, yeah, nobody like... I mean, he recommended using vodka because it would be kind of a blend.
Neutral.
Right, exactly. So you could see how the taste of the bagel would, you know, affect the drink. And then he said eventually when you get better, you could move on to whiskey and other things.
Is there an anti-vodka sentiment by the bartenders?
Yes.
Really?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's a very easy thing to mix into a cocktail.
So it's not really a challenge for the bartender.
Exactly.
Well, very fascinating. We have 28 fantastic shows on HRN that you can search any of them by name. We have an amazing new website that Jack was a major part in developing. So I encourage everyone to continue to visit our website, continue to turn into this show to hear the best of what's happened on the network. And we have an amazing show coming up.
Yes.
One of my favorite people and one of Anne's favorite people are here, but I like everyone. We have Liz Clark is here from Bubby's. She is a head butcher there and, you know, chef, and we're going to talk to her. We also have Ed from The Lowdown and his wife, and we are going to talk about The Lowdown, which is the definitive news source for Lower East Siders. So let's take a break, and we'll come back on the main course. Thank you. Back. If it's Sunday, it's the main course. I think it also might mean it's Meet the Press, but it also means it's the main course. We're in studio with Liz Clark, Ed Litvak, and Traven Rice. So, Liz, you're one of my favorite people in the food world. Tell me, what do you do and where do you work?
Well, I work at Bubby's down in One Main Street, Dumbo. Basically, I cut a bunch of meat up all week long.
Do you have strong forearms from doing that?
Yes, I do.
What are you cutting?
I'm cutting steer, one steer a week, and three whole pigs, and a bunch of other stuff, fish. But basically, mainly the attraction is the whole animal butchering that I do, cutting it, utilizing nose to tail, everything.
That's an interesting. You guys save money by doing that?
Yes, we do. And, you know, it's more expensive because we're, you know, having the whole, you know, grass-fed stuff. You could get it, you know, absolutely cheaper, you know, bones. We pay a flat rate for everything. But all in, it's good, you know, for the conscious, you know, to have this good meat. And it's not tainted. And I think that, you know, morally, it's better.
To support the local movement, do you have to be bringing in whole carcasses? I mean, is that what a necessity for supporting small farms?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, because then, you know, we're just only, you know, buying from farmer, and there's no middle person. So we're just buying directly and, you know.
To Bubby's credit, they do that with a lot of things, right? There's soda. They buck the system. They make their own soda. They make their own ketchup. Or I don't know, they seem to make a lot of things on their own, right?
Yes, yes.
Sauces.
We're all about, you know, just stripping, you know, and going back to the basis and making everything home, just like Grandma did it.
So give us a radio. What I loved about, we talked about this, Norman Corwin. He says, when you hear opera on the radio, you can imagine the most beautiful woman singing it, even though she's weighs like 400 pounds in real life. On radio, you know, you are the stage set designer. You are the costume person. So for our radio listeners, can you take us through the breakdown of a steer?
Well, basically, it's funny that you said opera, because in my mind, when I'm breaking down an animal, I do, you know, hear like the opera, and it's a dance. It's a dance that you're playing with the animal. The animal will definitely show you where, you know, all the muscles, you know, are connected. And I don't cut the meat. It's all about releasing the meat and cutting, you know, in the sinew, and just like letting everything like flop and just opening it up. And it's just like a beautiful, I almost like kind of like think of it as like a Rush song, where it's just very linearage, you know, and you're just like swiping left to right.
All right.
It's dance.
Jack will come up with a Rush song now for the break.
Yeah.
Well, one in particular that you think of?
No, I mean, okay. I just the drums, you know.
Very interesting. So you get this cow in, and what do you start? I mean, you cut the head off?
No. It's highly illegal that we get the head, just because of the whole mad cow disease and, you know, the tainting of the brains and stuff. I'll get the tongue, the offal and stuff, but
so you get a whole carcass split?
split in half and cut in three sections just because it's just weighs. I mean, one steer will weigh like a ton.
Yeah, you can't ask a delivery guy to
carry
that.
Yeah, there's no way. And the room of it, you know, you would need like a huge bench and chains, and we don't have the facility. We are a restaurant, you know, we're not a slaughterhouse. So it needs to be broken in subprimals. And then I cut it down in all of the primal.
And you start, what's the biggest challenge? I mean, take it. This is a radio
Basically show. The biggest challenge for me as a woman is lifting this god-awful crap.
What's each piece weigh? Like 100 pounds?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I do have help, but it's just definitely strenuous. It's yoga. It's a bunch of pulling. Like I said, you know, with butchering, with this whole, you know, breaking, bench breaking. Everybody can bandsaw meat. Anybody can do that, but when you do joint breaking and the art and you're just releasing every single muscle, it wears a toll on your body.
So why do you do that and not just use the bandsaw? Is it because of the bone fragments or because of the art?
It's the art. It's bringing it back. It's honoring the animal. You would have a lot of waste if you are bandsawing. And, you know, you want to utilize everything. I mean, I'm thinking of every day, like a new thing of utilizing, oh, this fat, you know, we can do candles, we can do soap, you know, the bones all for stock, offal, let's do, you know, a dinner, you know, because you can't really have like a lot of, you know, stuff on the menu that people are like, oh, you know, like going to buy it or not buy it, like, you know, eat it. So, you know, you got to, like, think of, like, ways to, you know, make specials out of this or that because you get one a week, mm-hmm. you know. And I would like on a rotation is to clear everything, like, a week.
So you do make soap? You give the fat to soap guys and stuff?
We're in the process of doing that, but probably more than likely we're probably going to do candles.
Oh, very
nice. Out of the soap. Every restaurant has candles. Why not?
And what's the saving grace for using all the parts of the animal? Is it the hamburger? Is that what allows you to just put in all the rest that you don't need? Or do you run a ton of specials every week to just move all the parts?
Running a ton of specials.
Really?
Yeah. And for me, you know, I just really like to utilize everything. You know, it's a kill. Let's strip it back. Like, I don't like to throw out anything. The only thing I will throw out is the glands, you know?
The glands. How do you divide the animal through your... You have a fancy Tribeca place and a lesser-known Brooklyn place because it's in Dumbo right by the water. It's really off the beaten path, even though it stares right at downtown New York. So how do you divide a cow up between the two restaurants?
Well, basically all the steaks, like ribeye, filet... strip loin, it's all gonna go to Tribeca because it gets sold out immediately. I keep the sirloins at Dumbo. I make roast beef out of the roast. I make my own combination of ground beef. We have really good hamburgers. It's you know, you just look at the animal and you say, okay, I'm going to take this part and I'm going to do something with this. And I'm going to take this part and I'm going to utilize this. Mm-hmm. And it's just the right thing to do.
Well, just to turn the wheel a little bit, I have a riddle for you.
Mm-hmm.
What do you call a Boston Red Sox player in October?
Well, this year, I'm home.
A spectator. It's always a spectator. Now, I know you are a huge Boston fan. In fact, you couldn't even come on radio a couple weeks ago because your dad and you had to watch the Pats play the Jets.
Yep. Yes. Well, I'm not a Pats fan. I'm a Jets fan, but I'm a Boston Red Sox fan.
Is that where you grew up?
No, absolutely not at all. I just hated the Yankees so much. I need to be a Boston Red Sox fan.
Give us the headlines. Where did you grow up? How did you become such a anti-Yankee?
Well, basically, I grew up in a very Irish Catholic family. My father is a big Yankees fan. He's from the Bronx off of Fordham Road. So it's good to like have the competition with your dad. Like you're going to root for the rivalry against your father, you know, just to like, you know, nag it, like to poke it. He's a Giants fan. I have to be a Jets fan. You know.
Got it. Yeah. And now, so you grew up on Fordham Road in New York?
No, I actually grew up in Queens, Woodside.
Okay.
And then in high school, my dad retired out of the police department and moved upstate in the New Paltz area.
Okay. And so, and that's where you grew up in the New Paltz area?
Yes.
And butchering, you just kind of need a job, and so you got into the industry, or was this something that you really sought to?
Butchering always followed me my whole entire life. I remember my dad taking me to a butcher shop every other Saturday, getting meat, and there was sawdust on the floor. I loved the smell. I was that kid that was like glued up against the glass, looking at the meat, looking at the liver, and being like, ooh, this is so cool, you know? My father is like, oh, you hear that bandsaw, you know, like traumatizing me, which, funny, the thing is I won't use a bandsaw. Like, I'll use everything. Like, I will debone, like, a back of a spine, like, mm-hmm. with a knife, because I refuse to use a band. I'm so scared of them. It's not even
You
funny.
Can really cut a finger off. We had Jacques Gauthier from Palo Santo did a No Goat Left Behind seminar for mm-hmm. us yesterday at Astor Center. It was a really great event organized by Aaron Fairbanks. And the reason we picked him to butcher the goat for us is because he only used the cleaver twice.
Mm-hmm.
And they were... I mean, once for the ribs, and then I think once for the back leg, and once for the front shoulder. Everything else was just with the knife.
Fabricated.
Yeah, he really, no shards of bone, nothing. It was really, you felt connected to some past way of doing things.
You really do. I mean, when you're running your hands on this animal with like the meat and the bone and the fat, like you really feel the life, you know, and you really get in tune with the animal and say, what can I do? You know, and kind of make this animal come alive again, you know.
What would you tell our listeners out there if they want to get into it and feel that same thing, but they don't want to bring in a whole cow? What cut of the cow or pig is the best way to kind of feel that thing that you're talking about?
I would say it would have to be the chuck. I think that it's...
What part of the cow is that?
It's the frontal, the chuck. You'll have, like, you know, nice roast. You can, you know, make chopped meat out of it. But the chuck is connected to the neck bone. And it's a really... There's two cool bones. You know, there's the paddle bone that's huge. You know, like, getting your knife underneath it and just, like, you know, making the bone be your guide and cutting around the meat, you know, letting the, you know, bone...
Very interesting. Well, I wanted to ask you this because it always fascinates me. I mean, tell me about the chef's life. I mean, you always talk about how it's a small community and mm-hmm. you've worked at a bunch of places. So tell me a little bit about the chef's life, the sustainable food movement through the lens of Liz Clark, like your hours, your life, who you hang out with. Tell us mm-hmm. about the community.
Well, I mean, I was absolutely spoiled because when I got into cooking... around 2001 upstate, there was chefs already buying from the farmers. So when I would go to work, the chef would call me before I would go to my job and be like, hey, stop by the farmer's market and see what's in season, you know, and I would pick up anything that was there and there would be market menus. And we would create a menu that day on what we got from the farmer's market. Mm-hmm. And for me, that is just like the best learning ground that I had. And I didn't realize that this was like, wow, I was spoiled, mm-hmm. you know, because now everybody's trying to pay catch up, you know, like down here. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, dude, I've been doing that so long.
Is there a lot of BS in this whole world? Like,
total.
I see these pictures of butchers with cigarettes hanging out of their mouth and the head under their arm. I'm like, oh my God.
Well,
like, when does that ever happen?
There are butchers. I don't like to call myself. I mean, I really don't, you know.
What, are you a chef?
Well, I just like to say cutter, you know, or because it's such an honor, you know, like you could spend your whole entire life, you know, mastering this lost art. I'm not there yet, you know, and I'm a person that... Any job that I have in the kitchen, I'm pretty much like the spine of the restaurant because I like to take on a lot, you know, and just running around and lead by example and work ridiculous hours.
Are you first in, last out?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, I can't really necessarily be last out right now, but I do work 65 hours and pull it in 5 days.
All right, Jack, 65 divided by 7. What is that? 60, that's a lot of hours a day.
That's a very, very long day.
Wow.
A very long day.
Are you exhausted?
9.2.
9.2.
I basically, sometimes, I mean, my girlfriend's here. I just fall, you know, I fall down, you know?
So let's ask her girlfriend. She's right here in studio. I mean, in what state is Liz after a 6-day work week? I mean, does she get broken down?
she does. I mean, I forget, like, the strenuous lifting and how physical her job is and the labor that she puts into it and working these days, these hard hours. You know, she comes off of her shifts or it's a weekend and I'm ready to go. I'm like, okay, we got to do this and this. Let's, you know, go here and there. And she does her best to keep up with me. But I know that it wears on her working these hours. But it's something she's passionate about. So
these weird feats of strength, like, can she just like pick up the couch and move it? And you're like, oh my God, you're yes. So strong.
Yes, all the time. I'm just like, oh, can you do that? No, she really does though.
Can you move the fridge to the other side?
Just for fun sometimes, just rearranging. Yeah.
That's awesome. So, Liz, tell us, do you hang out with other chefs? I mean, is it a tight community of cutters out there?
Yes. But, you know, we all work such crazy hours that there's like a limited time where we can actually like come and like, you know, all meet because, you know, one is, you know, oh, I got to work the weekends. I'm fortunate, you know, enough to not have to work brunch. Like, mm-hmm. This is the best thing, you know. So I have a Monday, you know, through Friday job. Mm-hmm. So it's hard. The people that you work with. Mostly, like, you'll work with people. People come and go. You kind of lose contact. We all lose contact because we're not working with each other. Mm-hmm. But when we're working with each other, we're like the same person, you know, crazy.
I always feel blessed that I get to talk to all these chefs every Monday and Tuesday to get their orders because it means that we're working together. Mm-hmm. You know, even if it's just once a week and for a 3-4 minute conversation, it does connect me and allow me to understand what's going on with the restaurant and all that. But yes, it's too bad that there's not like a guild or a consortium of cutters that just meet once a month and have mm-hmm. their own emblem and have a little clubhouse somewhere because mm-hmm. I'm sure there'd be a lot of exchanges. So my final question, you know, and I know you're going to stay in studio while we have Ed and Travin in, but so we're going to go to Occupy Wall Street. We're going to follow Michael Pollan's call after this. Why does Occupy Wall Street inspire you?
Because it's people taking a stand. And I hope that one day I'm just going to be like, you know what, to my job, like, I got to do this. Like, we need to take a break. And I kind of want to, you know, talk to the person I work with and say, hey, let's start donating mm-hmm. pies down there. I mean, we are Bubby's Pie Company. But then I think about it, I'm like, but we have lard in the pies. And I don't necessarily think that these protesters do eat meat, you know? And then I can see, like, the owner being like, oh, you know, and getting all mad. I'm like, relax, you know?
Actually, it's really funny. So when Nicole had the people feeding the protesters on her show, she said, you know, what's been the biggest complaint? And she said all the protesters complained there was no protein because all these people donated vegetables and organic vegan food and they started to say, what's the protein?
Yeah,
that's so funny. Well, no, meat's important, but it's funny. I've been only 2 weeks without a co-host. Katie just you know, broke off her show. She does a fantastic show called Straight No Chaser. So I've been 2 weeks without a host, and I'm like, Jack, this is amazing. I feel so free. And now after talking to Liz for 20 minutes, I'm like, Liz, be my co-host. I would totally be your co-host. So you just have to be. Let's start off this way. Very frequent guest, because you could just come on and hang out, and we'll mm-hmm. ask questions to whoever. Anyway. I really, really like you. You're one of the more pleasant, polite, considerate, attentive, intelligent people I work with. I work with probably 70, 80 chefs in New York City. And I'm really psyched that you came in on a Sunday. And I look forward to drinking more beer with you today. Mm-hmm. And I'm happy you're going to sit in for the next segment, which is going to have Ed at the Lowdown, Ed Livtak and Travin Rice. So stay tuned, and we're going to talk Lower East Side. Right, today's Tom Sawyer, mean, mean pride. Though his mind is not for them, don't put him down as arrogant. If he's ever We're back. It's a main course.
That was indeed Rush, by the way.
That was Rush. I love it. Jack, I mean, God, with the speed with which you can maneuver programs and computers and search stuff. You know, all the tags, there's probably 50 trillion tags on the HRN website now. That, you know, 97% of them came via Jack.
Yes.
Which, if we remember from statistics class, is statistically significant. And now we have very interesting. We have actual newsmakers. So, you know, we follow in your wake, you know, as newsmakers here on HRN, because Ed and Travin have been running the Lowdown. That's Lowdownny. So the Lowdown, no W-N-Y. .com. How long have you guys been running the Lowdown?
For a little over 2 years, we were running the Lowdown. I came from a standard network television background. Travin is a filmmaker, a filmmaker. I'm a recovering network news producer.
Oh wow!
So that's our background.
So you guys kind of in the Occupy Wall Street way, you kind of left corporate structure to venture out on an entrepreneurial venture.
It's very true.
So how did, I mean, tell me about that. That's fascinating to me. I mean, what inspired you to give up stability and, you know, all that?
Well, I mean, the thing that inspired me initially to give up stability was losing my job.
Oh, okay.
Like about a million other journalists across the country in the last few years. It was really Travin's idea. We had only lived on the Lower East Side for about a year at that point, or 2 years maybe, I guess, and you know, you sort of start walking around and opening your eyes and seeing how fascinating it is.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that our experience has been just that. It's like layers of an onion, and it just gets more interesting every day.
I thought you were going to say it stinks more, because I know that.
Well, there's that
Essex Market Street that's pretty dirty street
in August in Chinatown. That's very much true.
So tell me, Travin, tell me about the seminal moment, this catalyst moment that you had when you came up with this idea. Like, what inspired it?
Well, we, we were enmeshed with sort of the falling apart of the news industry, just as far as TV news. And
where were you?
I'm a filmmaker.
Oh, so you were in the news.
My background is film and theater and television. So, and I was not involved in reporting of any kind. But we had been watching everything, and, you know, everyone was talking about the death of the newspaper and the death of print, and then the TV news scenario was pretty dismal. And then we started seeing smaller news websites. There was a hyper-local trend happening mm-hmm. around the country. People that Ed had worked with were starting up different online news, you know, community news, kind of, they call it hyper local, but it's been around forever, obviously, reporting in your neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And it was happening in Seattle, it was happening a lot in Brooklyn, and we just looked to see, is it happening in our neighborhood? And it was not happening. So we saw an opportunity, and then the more we thought about it, we thought, why is it not happening here? And let's just give it a go and see what happens. Let's just go for it and start writing about the different dynamics and different communities and everything that's happening right here.
How do you define your community? Is there, like, does it cut off? I mean, do you cover Occupy Wall Street, or does it go up to 14th Street?
Well, we haven't covered Occupy Wall Street because it is a little bit further west. Our sort of outer boundary on the west side is Broadway, mm-hmm. but it's really the Bowery.
Bowery to
and
the river.
So we will go up. You know, there was a big story we covered this week that was just below 14th Street, but mainly we stay below Houston.
What was your first story ever?
Our first story ever was there was a community meeting to talk about the bike lanes on Grand Street. It was very controversial.
Yes, it is.
And I showed up, and you had the Orthodox Jews, the hipsters, the Chinese community and the Latino community all converging on this this community.
And we all know the Jews and the Chinese do not obey traffic laws. It's amazing. They have that one thing in common. They just blatantly cross
although
the
they
street.
Would say that the bicyclists don't obey the traffic laws. So,
and, so hypocritical.
And, so it was quite a scene, and I wrote about it, and you know we were just I don't think that we were all that serious about the lowdown as a business at that point. And
but it is a business. You sell sponsorships,
to this
right?
Day, it is a business and nearly a viable business. But at that point we were kind of messing around. And I wrote a story and about all these people yelling at each other and the drama. The very popular New York City blog Gothamist picked it up.
Okay.
And wrote about us as if we were this established presence. And I thought, wow, this is a strange world we're living in. And then it just kind of took off from there.
So without the Gothamist, you would have had fewer people reading that article. So how tell our listeners who are like, we want to start something in our local community similar, whether they're in Kansas City or Las Vegas. So how does one get a listenership of worth?
Well, I mean, I think that the way the world works now, you just start doing it. I think that the sort of the less you really sort of think and plan in mm-hmm. some ways, and the more it's organic and it grows the way it's meant to grow and the way you want it to grow, that I think that's where you're better off. And as everybody knows, and pretty much everybody has a blog these days,
yeah.
It's not a hard thing to do.
How do you cover a neighborhood? What do you have? How many people work with
well,
you?
Well, it's Traven and I full time,
okay.
And we have five or six contributors, and we have some other people. And
are they paid for their contributions?
They are mostly not paid.
Okay.
We have an associate editor who is fantastic. She's an investigative reporter. She works with us part time, and then we have a developer that we couldn't exist without. He's a website, guy that does all of that for us. And we have a brilliant designer who's contributing for free, who's fantastic, which is why we look so good. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of people chipping in to help because
okay.
they like what we're doing.
And what are you doing? I mean, are you covering breaking news stories? Are you covering Hollywood stories? I mean, do you draw the line?
Yeah, well, no, we don't really draw the line. It's everything from breaking news.
Meat shops opening.
Crime stories. Meat shops opening, exactly. The Essex Street Market is a big story for us. The way it's developing, what its future is.
Mm-hmm.
A story that's near and dear to your heart. I think that what's happening there is incredibly interesting and a microcosm of our entire community.
Because they're talking about moving it, so you're probably following it on a lot of levels, the city level,
right,
down
right.
to Batista, to the people that shop there.
Exactly.
Very interesting. So how do you break stories? I mean, do people, do you have your contacts out there and you call them and you're like, what's happening?
Well, more and more, people, send us tips and tell us things that they think, are important. But, we also, attend all the community board meetings. We have contacts with the political leadership in the neighborhood and the thing that was the biggest learning curve for me is just learning to open my eyes as I walk down the street. I think as a New Yorker, sometimes you're just sort of trained not to look at too much.
Mm-hmm. Civil inattention, they
yeah.
call it.
So, but I think that what a lot of neighborhood bloggers have really been good at. Both in our community and other communities, is being observant, and that's half the battle.
And so if the Times leans to the left and the Post leans to the right, where would you put the lowdown on that spectrum?
Well, I mean, I think that we try not to have an ideology. I think that what a lot of neighborhood blogs, especially in our neighborhood, have been, and I think that they provide a really great service.
Mm-hmm.
They have a very strong point of view for the most part. And we have decided not to have a point of view.
Mm-hmm.
We're pro-community.
Is that possible?
Well, it's probably not possible to be to have no point of view whatsoever. Everybody brings their life experiences and their whatever else to the table. We try to suppress that as much as possible because we really want everybody to be able to tell their own stories. Mm-hmm. And so it's great that, you know, that various people in the community have a point of view, and we want to them to be able to fully express themselves.
It seems like, by definition, Lower East Side, you're to the left. I mean, just the very people you interview. I mean, that's got to be a democratic enclave, I would think. But that is impressive that you try to remain. I'm sure every legitimate news organization says that, including Fox. But now, what about big topics of now? Any stories you might want to break on here? Oh. Is there a crime spree about to happen?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a serious situation going on with crime in our neighborhood. And it was a big story this past week. And a teenager, an 18-year-old kid, was killed in a public housing development on 12th Street. So he was just buried over the weekend, and I think there's going to be a lot of repercussions.
Was it an outrageous circumstance?
He was definitely involved in not the greatest stuff in the world. Probably some drugs. Probably weapons of various sorts. I think that what it really speaks to is the fact that in this city's public housing projects, things are not all right, and there is a cycle of poverty and a cycle of violence that families are having a very hard time escaping.
Mm-hmm. Well, I view that as part of the Occupy Wall Street movement as well. I mean, it goes back to Robert Moses and putting poor people in these massive structures, thinking like that would be a way of dealing with them, when in reality it just kind of festered over the years. But well, very, very interesting.
I have a breaking crime story from the Lower East Side. I had a DJ gig on Friday night, and somebody stole one of the DJ's laptops.
So really?
There we go.
Well, that's a cover story right there.
There you go.
It's also possible that the DJ was stoned and just forgot where he put it.
I'll tell you, though, no, we do these events all over the place, and there are never problems like that. And, you know, first time in the Lower East Side, and immediately someone's laptop just gets stolen. So
it is very sad, people that steal stuff. What is the website for people to go to?
The lowdownny.com. And as you pointed out earlier, no W in the low.
And do you sign up for it? People have to give their email address, and then they'll get, a daily email?
Yeah, well, if you want, we have an email that goes out every afternoon that is a full text of every story we've done that day.
Okay.
It's usually about half a dozen stories or so.
A day?
Yep.
And do you give is that email a protected email, or does that email go to other groups?
It does not go anywhere else.
Okay, great.
It does not go anywhere else.
So you're really protected, and you get to follow, especially if you live on the Lower East Side or work there. I mean, there's definitively no better news source, for sure.
Well, thank you for saying so.
The only fault is that you haven't covered Occupy Wall Street. But we all know
we'll
that's bound to happen.
Well, I know that, you know, there is a Lower East Side angle with Anne, you know, I understand. So
she made 100 sandwiches. Yeah. Her forearms, she can literally lift me by the neck. She has stronger hands. I have very dexterous hands. I can, tip a football to myself, but they're weak hands in the end. So, I always admire Anne for being able to outshake me and do all these things. But she donated 100 sandwiches, or, you know, helped make 100 sandwiches, and, you know, she makes those herself. So, I mean, she's really working it.
Delicious
and
sandwiches.
We, Heritage Foods, was proud to donate a couple of hams to the Occupy Wall Street effort. So, you know, I don't even know what Occupy Wall Street is, but I believe it. You know, it's probably a lot of things, but, you know, I believe in populist movements against, you know, non-equal sharing of wealth. So, anyway, this has been a really, really fun show. Jack, I think Week in Review did pretty good today.
Yeah, we're on it. We'll get better.
We'll get better every day. The network will get better. Bubbies will get better. Lowdown will get better. This has been a really great show. Thanks so much, Liz, for coming on.
Thank you, Patrick.
Ed and Travin, thanks so much for coming on. And stay tuned for Shaken, Not Stirred.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.